Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's just such an auspicious time to be together and to feel all of our energies coming with great effort to practice our way offered to us by the Buddha during this time of Rohatsu. Even with all the Oryoki training, I feel there's energy and some sense of stillness in the room. So, I actually have been very engaged. I haven't really studied the Satipatthana for quite a while, but I have recently again, and it's just been a very meaningful experience, and so I'm looking forward to sharing some of my understandings. And, you know, this Satipatthana is really one of the most important teachings of the Buddha, and was offered by the Buddha in relation to the coming under the Bodhi tree, the realization of the Four Noble Truths. And we all know them, but to bring them into the room seems really important, because this whole text, the Satipatthana, is about how do we practice in relation to these truths so that we can realize enlightenment and we can realize, you know, the possibility that we can live through the Buddha's eyes. And so, you know, suffering is universal. And even in this moment, there's suffering in this room. There's suffering beyond this room. And we all know that it's part of being human, really, that we don't always get what we want, that we can become sick, we can have grief and loss, we grow old and we die. And this is the first noble truth, and that this is true of all human beings, all living beings. And then the second noble truth is that the cause of suffering is desire. It has different aspects, because we can desire something that brings great happiness and great satisfaction, and yet we also crave more, or we want to hold on to it, or we want to take charge of it in some way. And so desire can go the other way too, where desire leads us down paths of negative experiences, like feeling hate or hurt or shame. And all these negative experiences are also a cause of suffering, because when we encounter them, we tend to want to turn away. We don't want to feel that kind of suffering. And then the third noble truth is basically the Buddha's cure for these afflictions. When we realize that we can't hold on and we can't turn away, and we also can't hold on to a belief that we are separate individual beings worthy of our own fulfillment in life. that actual belief is a delusion that actually is also a cause of suffering, because in this delusion that we're separate selves, we're moving against the deepest truth of what life is all about. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, and at the beginning starts out with sati, mindfulness, and then leads to investigation or contemplation. So this whole teaching in the Satipatthana is offering us how do we practice so that we can realize these truths and then be released from these truths into this larger truth of the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha mind. So we began on Monday with Jim talking about the first mindful, I have to go back for a moment because I want to just refresh us. I feel like because we're practicing hearing these teachings more than once is needed so that they're fresh in our day to day. So sati means to remember, to bring our full attention into the now, into the present moment. Sati means bringing our awareness in such a way that it's what we call bare attention, that we're just present and noticing and aware, but we're not elaborating on it. We're not creating thoughts and plans from it. We're just being fully present. And in this, then, patana means to set forth or to give great effort. And from this patana, we move into this present moment from a boundless state of mind. This is what satipatthana means. And it's really about not changing our experience, not trying to improve anything, but to see things as they are, to come to a clarity of what life really is about. So as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, in practicing satipatthana, we have to put all interpretations, all judgments aside. And even if they're there, we can register that we have them, but we have to let them go in order to be fully here now. So we bring our attention into the now with mindfulness. And I was interested in what Norman Fisher said about mindfulness too, because mindfulness is really more immediate than there are words for it. We often so quickly put words on our experience that we're a little bit removed from the moment that we're being mindful of. So when we're mindful, we're aware of what's arising and not trying to label it. So another way to think of this is like choiceless awareness, that in the moment, whatever's arising is rising, not of our effort, not of our intention, not of our wish. So this mindfulness isn't really being a distant observer. It's more being present, being near. It's about giving up control, having faith. There's a kind of spontaneousness in the mindfulness because it's so raw in a way, this present moment. And so maybe I would like to ask you to indulge with me in this little exercise to get a feeling in your body of what this bare attention, this mindfulness, being present to what's arising could be like. So I learned this from Susan Moon. And she said, first of all, be the present moment, the mindful present moment. Be that. And imagine that you're walking down this dirt road in this presence and mindfulness place. And there's a little stream going by. And as you look across the stream, it's like, oh, there's Dora Lee. She's over there. Or there's Sarah. Or there's Rose. It's like, oh. And as we're walking in this mindful presence and we turn towards, you know, our little self, suddenly, oh, I didn't notice you before. I didn't quite see you the way I'm seeing you now. Something fresh opens up. And then I'm imagining, anyway, the Dora Lee over there is sort of looking over to presence and saying, I feel so relieved. There's some space here around me. I'm not so pressured to feel like I have to be a certain kind of way. And so here is a kind of dance, really, between presence, bringing sati into the moment, and connected to what's arising in us, in our personal lives. So, I don't know if you're letting yourself imagine now, but you take that in as a way to cultivate this quality of satipatthana. Because, as other people have said, this presence needs to be sort of light, not pressure, focused, intense. It's light. It's open. It's welcome. It's noticing. There's one other piece of this process that is part of the guideline for how we practice, and it's the process of contemplation. So when we begin to notice something, then we want to practice contemplation, which has to do with, we can look at something and walk quickly by and hardly notice anything. You might see a beautiful flower, but if you stop for a moment and look at the flower, suddenly you see so many other things that you hadn't noticed before, like the stems or the color of the leaves, or maybe there's a flower that's dying. You see all of this because you're staying with your dwelling. And this practice of contemplation relates to the Four Noble Truths, because in order to do this, you begin to see more deeply without the opinions and the reactions that are usually around us. So here's one way to talk about contemplation: by turning awareness to different facets of one's subjective experience, these aspects will be experienced simply as objects, and the notion of a solid I will begin to dissipate. You can ask, well, what's this? What's happening now? And we begin to see the conditions of our lives. We're not changing our experiences, but we're deepening them. And by this turning in contemplation, we're beginning to practice the cure of suffering. Letting go of self. Letting go of holding on to a fixed view. So the Buddha says, this fourfold practice, and what we're going to be doing, Jim went to the mindfulness of body, I'm the mindfulness of feeling, tomorrow's the mindfulness of mind, and someday is the mindfulness of dharmas. And this is really a stage model that hopefully you'll begin to see that each is built on the other to open us more deeply into all the dimensions of the causes of suffering that still are affecting our lives. So the Buddha says, this is the direct way, monks, for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the extinguishing of suffering and grief, and for the walking on the path of truth to the realization of nirvana. This is the direct way. So, even though I'm on the second mindfulness practice, I want to come back to the body, because this is really the ground of everything about what it means to be alive. And as Jim said, we are body. We are body. We cannot be alive if we're not a body. And we are the earth. I didn't learn until recently that the Hebrew word for human beings is the same word as earth. So even from this moment of coming into direct contact with the body, again, we begin to let go of of this sense of holding on to self, because we can't be in our body without being aware of, oh, my breath is taking in the oxygen from the plants. The heat that leaves me at 97 degrees Fahrenheit is from the sun. You begin to see that, no, I'm a separate person. We're part of everything. And that's what life's all about. So the truth of the impermanence of everything is also the truth of the interconnectedness of everything. And so by staying in our bodies and staying grounded there, we're already opening on a different level. So I mean, we, just to think about it, you know, we, part of the practice of the foundation of the body is to be aware of walking, sitting, lying down, standing up. Basic activities of human life are, we can just be with them and notice. And it's, this is the beginning of cultivating wholeheartedness. Because I don't know about you, but often I can be walking along and thinking I'm fine until I notice that my mind is somewhere else. And I'm not even paying attention to walking, what that's like, how it feels. And basic life activities, like, I mean, hands are so amazing. Just to appreciate our hands, because our hands, that's how we care for each other. We cook. We make things. Sometimes I'm amazed at what my hands will be doing before I'm even aware of it. You know, oh, they know how to take the top off the tin can, and they know a lot of things. So that love can come through our hands, or hatred can come through our hands. So just the contemplation of all these basic activities is part of what it means to come into the body. And when we forget, when we feel, off center, we come back to the body. So this practice always has to be the foundation. And of course, mindfulness of the body is fraught with mindfulness of impermanence. And I just look at my feet now, and they're old. They aren't the way they used to be. When I was in pain in my body, it brought up so much about the impermanence of my life. So in this context then, if we move to mindfulness of feelings, and I actually, in the book that I primarily study, it's called mindfulness of feelings, but I think it makes more sense to call this mindfulness of feeling, because feeling now arises from the body in relation to contact. It's the feeling level that makes contact with the world. You walk outside your door and you see the sun. Something arises in the body when you make contact. And so, it helps me to think of mindfulness of feeling as being aware of, for example, resonating or touching, or something struck a chord, or I was stopped in my tracks. I saw a bird in a tree, and suddenly a poem arose. From where? From this felt feeling in the body. I love Mary Oliver says, feeling is like some strengthening throb of amazement. It's not really just an emotion per se. It's not a discrete label. It's this level of connection that arises from the body. And that is so important to understand how this feeling level is connected to what it says in the Satipatthana. Hold on. And how, monks, does he regard, in regard to feelings, abide contemplating feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, he knows, I have a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unpleasant feeling. when feeling a neutral feeling, he knows I feel a neutral feeling. And this can also go in regards to unpleasant feelings. When an unpleasant feeling arises, you know this is an unpleasant feeling. When an unpleasant feeling is absent, you know it's not here. So the start of the practice starts with being aware of something as pleasant or unpleasant. And at first I kind of didn't like that because I thought, well, this is such a big label of things. But then I began to understand through dialogue with my friend Beth Jacobs, who's a scholar of the Abhidharma, that the pleasant feeling is often something that we don't literally notice because we're caught up in it. So, you know, I might have had a wonderful day and I'm enjoying myself, and before I know it, oh, this is so great, you know, I wish I could do this again, and my greed is taking over, but I didn't notice the moment of pleasant. And this noticing actually is in the body and often is outside of our awareness. So we're being asked now in this practice, this is mindfulness, to begin to cultivate this capacity to recognize, oh, pleasant feeling. Because once we recognize, then we're not caught in it anymore. We begin to be able to not be so attached, not have to cling or hold on, which is what the Buddha says is one of the causes of suffering. So, I'll never forget, I think I've shared this before, but I had this incredible experience in Oriyoki where I just felt like I'm enjoying eating in a way I never have before. And I thought, ah, this is great. This is how I want to eat. And the next day I got really depressed and I couldn't figure it out for the whole day. Why? Why am I so depressed? And then what I realized was, oh, I'm holding on. I wanted this to be a fixed state. So there's a lot of richness that comes with this bare attention to pleasant. And this also goes for unpleasant, because unpleasant feelings often lead us into turning away, lead us into avoidance. And often those are defense mechanisms that we don't even know are going on. And then if we don't know they're going on, then that unpleasant experience that you now don't want to look at or feel often turns up into some kind of acting out, you know, where you might hurt another person, or you might say something that you wish you hadn't said, because it's all being fueled by this unpleasant turning away. So again, this is a kind of mindfulness awareness. And it makes a big difference to be aware, to notice. Because, and you can see how it's a bodily experience, because pleasant, you want to grab onto it. Unpleasant, you want to push it away. So that's another way to begin to notice it, because it will be a bodily reaction that might not have words or explanation. Maybe you can see this already, but one of the problems with not being aware, with not stopping and seeing the pleasant or the unpleasant, is that it leads to thoughts, judgments, actions. It begins to form how we are in the world. So this feeling level is the level of the colors of our lives, and they're in the background. And so we can't just talk about judgments or opinions by themselves, because they're fueled by these feeling states. And so this is what's so crucial, because once we begin to notice this and see the connection between the feeling of pleasant, for example, and then what we do next, and what we think next, and what we judge next, the goal is to have no view. The true liberation of our possibility of being human is to be so connected and so aware and so mindful that we have no view. And in that having no view, we're open. You know, the capacity to be compassionate and mindful comes through. We only have 5 more minutes. The other side of this, okay, so once you've got this like gross level of pleasant, unpleasant, then it really deepens our lives to become more attentive to all the flavors of pleasant and unpleasant. Like for example, something may be pleasant, but if you really look inside to how it lives in your body, it's like, oh, I felt so tender talking to my grandchild. It was such a wonderful experience, the experience of tenderness. And these differentiations bring a richness to our experience, but also it deepens our capacity for compassion, our capacity for empathy to other people, so that interconnectedness actually is nurtured by this contemplation of feelings. And then the other piece of this is to be aware of the vicissitudes of feelings by looking at the social context of a feeling. And I couldn't believe I thought of this morning, because this was like, I don't know, 30 years ago or something. But my daughters, as they were growing up, were really into the Cabbage Patch Kids. It was like a whole fad. Everybody had to have these Cabbage Patch dolls. And so, and of course, I'm a mother, and I love being with dolls. And anyway, we went to this big store in Manhattan that was just a store of Cabbage Patch dolls. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, they had a little, like fake garden with these cabbages, and inside the cabbages, these dolls would emerge and had all these clothes. And I was like, I was in the store, and I said, John, I have to have my own Cabbage Patch doll. It was like this incredible craving. And it was so powerful. And I said, please, please. And he said, no. But the thing is, I walked outside the door, completely went away. Completely. So this is another part of the teaching in the Satipatthana, that we become aware of our contexts and understand all the causes and conditions, the codependent arising that, in a sense, enables the feeling states of, you know, like, I mean, even in the news, you know, I notice the context of listening to the news. If the context for me is more than 5 minutes, I'm in a definite unpleasant experiential state. But if I stop before the 5 minutes are over, you know, I can kind of handle it. So, you know, in every situation, to look at the context is really important. And to also look at the vicissitudes of feelings, how they come and go. I mean, I can feel a little lonely, and then suddenly the doorbell rings, I open the door, a neighbor has come. I'm not lonely anymore. I mean, there's a sort of vicissitudes of feeling too, which is another teaching. We don't want to be attached because they come and go. That's not the ground of our practice life. Let's see.
The schedule is just a suggestion.
Okay.
Yeah, so, please.
Because there's a couple other things I really want to share, because in this chapter on the mindfulness of feeling, it talks about worldly feeling and unworldly feeling. And this is where we get into the ethics of this practice. Because the feelings we've been talking about so far are deeply connected with our sensate life in the world and our situations. But the ethic in all of that is restraint. And this is an important, another discovery, because if I want something really, really badly, and, you know, my whole body is saying, oh yeah, have that other Starbucks coffee, or whatever it is, and then I say, no, I'm not going to have that. This practice, again, begins to work on this transformation of the causes of suffering, because we then begin to realize that our sense of aliveness is not dependent on this or that or this or that, and it strengthens us. There's a kind of energy, a virya, that comes just from restraint. So, but then there's the unworldly feeling states. And this, I think, is what happens when we enter samadhi in our meditation practice, which is when we're in this place where all the mindful things are going around, but then all of a sudden, while resting in stillness, the teaching comes up in some way. Like I could, the other day I was sitting, and all of a sudden the phrase, without pride, easily contented and joyous. It's a phrase in the loving kindness meditation. And here's the example of the contact. Something in me, it really resonated, made contact with this phrase. And it was like, oh. And I began like just saying it over and over again, and just beginning to wonder, without pride, easily contented and joyous. What's that like? How can I cultivate that? So here, we're in another level of, it's not about clinging and letting go, it's about allowing the Dharma to begin to affect how we feel, and what we do, and how we think. And then even in this place of samadhi, where I think it's easier for us to feel the suffering of other people. When we're busy in our lives, it's not so easy sometimes. But in this samadhi state, where the Dharma itself is beginning to move us, we see more. We see the suffering of the world, but we're not consumed by it. We can actually meet it and be present. And then I also learned that the Buddha realized that the experience of joy, which you could put in the classification of a pleasant feeling, is different. Joy is a gift of the opening of, you know, the awakening factors that are opening us to the way, to living these teachings. And this experience of joy is something that we should savor, that we should pay attention to, that we should be glad it's here. We should make space for it. Because this joy comes in response to what is good. But it's connected. It's not about, you know, non-sensual joy, you know, or anything like that. It's really considered non-sensual joy, the pleasure that naturally opens us up to want to practice more deeply, to stay in a kind of deep state of contemplation. And I really saw this. I was at Upaya for a training, and Joan Halifax, who's the founder and leader of Upaya was there, and maybe some of you don't know, but she had open heart surgery, and she was still in deep recovery, so she was very wan and weak, and she's partially blind. She had to have somebody walk around with her, and so she had to leave sometimes and go and rest. But when she was present and spoke, the energy was full of joy. It was just incredible, and love. And it emanated. And it emanated in such a way that I could see that she saw things that other people weren't noticing from the joy. So the joy itself opens again our awareness. At the same time, we don't want to get attached to joy too. So again, you see the causes of suffering coming through: attachment, holding on. So joy is a gift. And when it's there, we welcome it. So thank you for listening. Here we are. We're tending the garden of our life. We sit zazen and walk hinhin. We're eating mindfully together, and we're taking care of the weeds of our mind heart. We're turning these sufferings into mulch to form fertilizers deep in the ground. We don't get rid of anything. It's all here. And in our great effort, the fertility of our garden will grow on its own. It's nothing for us to do. It happens on our own. So, in the Dhammapada it says, as a bee drinks nectar and then flies away without harming the flower, so should a bhikkhu in bhikkhuni. And bhikkhuni wander through a village. May we all be bhikkhus and bhikkhunis together with the flower never going away. Thank you. I'm not sure if we just go returning to Kinhin, or do we, is there questions or comments? Or?
I have a comment or an experience to relate that I think comes right out of your talk. So I was listening to your talk, and I was really enjoying myself listening to your talk. And then, I don't know, a point came and my energy started to sag, and I wasn't as happy as I was a moment before. And this is sort of like right there, pleasant experience, wonderful, pleasant experience. Oh, not so pleasant experience. Yeah. And so, what did Neo say once? Something like, or maybe it was Reb anyway. Somebody said, so you just ride the horse, just stay in the saddle. I think that's Mio who said, just stay in the saddle, And so to me, this is like our practice related to pleasant experience, unpleasant experience.
Coming and the going.
Just stay in the saddle, okay? Pleasant, wonderful, oh, not so pleasant, kind of sagging. Okay, stay in the saddle. Thank you.
Thank you, Dorley. That was beautiful. And yeah, it reminded me of an experience that I had back in 2011 and led me, one of the experiences that led me on this cushion today. And I had probably just heard the Buddha's message from PBS or something around the same time, but in 2011, I found myself representing these parties that was venued in San Francisco, and it was a contractual dispute, and it was very contentious. And I remember I had to drive to San Francisco for an 8:30 trial call, and I still remember I had to wake up at like 4:30 in the morning, pack my car with banker's box after banker's box, and I still remember the weight in my car, and I was just so nervous driving to San Francisco, and the traffic was crazy, and it was a night of a supermoon, and I'm just driving scared, thinking of my opening arguments, and then dwelling, and I finally kind of wound down the mountain getting into the Bay Area, and then all of a sudden there it was, the supermoon full on the bay, and I was just like, boom, caught by it, and all of that stuff was just gone. And then I had to start labeling it, going off of that tangent.
Yeah. Yeah. Just gone.
Do we have time for one more? Your talk made me, there's a lot of parallels that I've been experiencing since I've been sitting meditation, but most recently, the feeling of joy. And it happened to me last night? Wait. The last time we had to meditate and then we got to walk, I think we were on Zoom. So I had come back, I was very cold. We were outside doing the walk, and I came back to my cushion, and it was warm, and I felt like it was a nest, and it was very comfortable. But then I had this huge surge of joy. So 25 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, I got in a lot of trouble drinking and driving. And so I was working with an AA sponsor, and so I had to write down all of my character defects. And she told me that I could tell a priest. Well, I was raised Catholic. And so I went down to the Clarksburg to his father, and I asked him to hear my confession. And he said, "Child, you're filled with guilt. Leave your guilt here, and I will sit on it for you." All right? And I was like, great, okay. And so in that moment of returning to my nest, I felt such joy that I could sit on the cushion and be inside myself and have, excuse me, just the deep reflection and gratefulness. Thank you.
And you're wanting to really, treasure that joy, because you've come home.
And it wouldn't be if I didn't sit